Hello, you're listening to Voices from the Center, podcasting from the Overturning Tables website. This is episode 12, and we're going to look at the Native American community and gaming. I met a guy a few months back named Dan Brown, not the author of the Da Vinci Code, but a different Dan Brown, a man of the Ho-Chunk tribe here in Wisconsin, and we hit it off. There was a good vibe between us. We spent some time hanging out, and I decided I wanted to interview Dan. Dan manages a gaming facility in Madison and had just a completely different perspective on gaming as a believer than I had or had heard any time before. Dan is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. It comes from the word Ho-Chungra, meaning people of the sacred language. Originally, the Ho-Chunk were part of the Winnebago tribe, but when they were forcibly removed from Wisconsin and relocated to Minnesota and Nebraska, those that migrated back became known as the Ho-Chunk. So I interviewed Dan the other day as a follower of Jesus, managing a casino, and began to understand that Indian gaming predates casinos by a long shot, as we'll learn from Dan. And nor does gambling have any kind of negative connotation within the Native American church. The connection between Native reservations and casinos grew out of a really interesting story. A Chippewa couple living in a mobile home on a reservation in Minnesota got a property tax bill from their county, and they had never gotten a property tax bill before. So they refused to pay and took it to court. And they lost in several court battles all the way to the Minnesota Supreme Court, losing that. But they asked the U.S. Supreme Court to review the decision. And very interestingly, there was a unanimous overturning of that Minnesota Supreme Court ruling. The U.S. Supreme Court held not only that states don't have authority to tax Indians or Indian reservations, but that they also lack the authority to regulate Indian activities on reservations. It wasn't long after that that Indian gaming became a thing, beginning with some bingo halls on reservations. The story highlights the relationship of sovereignty with the Native community, but there's some other interesting threads that I think you'll find. Let's listen in to my interview with Dan Brown. And just in terms of nomenclature, like, when do you use Indian, when do you use Native, and how do those terminologies kind of play out in terms of what feels respectful in your community?
Great question. Really, it's a personal choice, I think, more than anything. I don't know that tribal people, Ho-Chunk people anyway, get real hung up on, we're Ho-Chunk, is what we are. And so when we're talking amongst ourselves, we might ask, you know, is the stones over there, are they Native? So maybe Native, we don't get into, I don't hear a lot of our people talking about, you know, Native Americans. We'll still use the term Indian at the time, or to me, the people that I associate with, it's not a negative term. But for us, we're Ho-Chunk.
Let's talk about morality of gaming and perceptions about morality around gaming. Now, you're a Christian, part of the Native church.
Right.
What are some of the complaints, concerns that you get from people who are claiming a sort of moral high ground and attacking casinos? What are their arguments, or what do they toss out at you as this is immoral because?
Well, I start out by saying that I'm a baptized and confirmed Episcopalian from my father's side, and I'm a baptized Native American church member from my mother's side. And in my 52 years on the planet, neither side has ever told me that gambling is bad, whether in church or in a service or you know, in any environment. So I don't internalize that because it's never been taught to me, so I don't understand it. But to speak to your question, yes, we do hear that. And I've not received what I would consider an argument that I could wrap my head around, because I truly don't understand it. There are those who have an aversion because they believe it's going to bring about social ills. And I'm not here to start pointing fingers at any other vices out there, be it drinking or anything like that, to say, well, that's that's legal and smoking or whatever. The point of the matter is it's all personal choice. Does a person, feel okay about coming in and playing? We don't call it gambling. And I think more just to soften the language, because gambling, for whatever reason, seems to have a negative connotation out there.
It doesn't in the Native community.
No, not at all. So we just have, I just have a difficult time with those that would be so outspoken about an issue that doesn't directly affect them. If it does affect them, then certainly if it's a family member, then there are programs out there for intervention and for assistance. And when we hear that, we're to a point where we sort of shrug our shoulders and, you don't want to come out and participate and enjoy this sort of entertainment, then don't.
So, form of entertainment not unlike going to a concert where you might pay $100 to see a headliner,
right,
or a football game.
Right. But, having said that, it's a type of entertainment that if I go out to... Well, if I go to a football game and I spend X amount on a ticket, X amount on parking, X amount on food, X amount on drink, I've got no chance of getting that back, right? If you, I might sound like a little bit of a salesman, but if you come here and you enjoy just the play, I might just walk out with a little bit more than what I walked in with.
What do you think about those who complain that gaming is a tax on the poor, it elevates their hopes in thinking, I've got $100 to live this week and I'm going to spend it because I think I can double it, that kind of thing. Do you see that here at this facility? How do you receive that complaint?
Yeah, and that's a legitimate complaint. We certainly aren't here to hurt anybody. We want people to enjoy themselves responsibly. We want to be able to provide assistance to those who we believe might be having some problems. We are members of the problem gambling organization here within the state. In fact, my municipal relations coordinator, Missy Tracy, is a board member of that organization. So we are watchful of those types of situations. The person comes in wearing the same clothes for a couple of days, or they're falling asleep at a machine, or they're here, employees are seeing them on a far too frequent basis, then we are apt to intervene and just ask, is everything okay? We want to be very careful with that because we don't want to be insulting, but we just want to make it very clear that we're not here to hurt anybody. We don't want to, we don't want to cause any issues with anyone.
How about the complaint that gambling brings in criminal activity?
That's actually kind of laughable, and most people who understand what we do out here know that it's actually what we have here is a deterrent, a real serious deterrent, because of the security that we have here, because of the surveillance. If we spot anything that seems even remotely suspicious, our security will address the issue. They will approach folks, in the facility and out in our parking lot. So. I talked to, back when I used to manage the facility at Wisconsin Dells, the Sauk County Sheriff at the time was Randy Stamen, and Randy and I sat down one time and I said, it's a complete and utter myth that gambling brings about, crime. And I asked him, well, what's your opinion of it? And he said, if there's a higher concentration of people, there's a higher likelihood that something might occur. But he said, there's nothing to indicate that a casino brings about a higher number or a higher level or activity of crime.
Just touring your facility, I would have to think, these facilities bring in riffraff, those riffraff are probably mostly in their 70s. You just don't think of the elderly as those who bring a lot of crime with them.
No, no.
And they enter communities.
Right, right.
Is gaming, does it go back very far in Native culture?
Yeah. And again, I should preface this by saying that I'm not someone who knows all things Indian or all things Ho-Chunk, but I have some knowledge. Yeah, and speaking directly to that question, I'm told that we had gaming as a part of our culture, you know, from the beginning of time. There's games that we still play with our traditional people, and so gambling has been a way of life, you know, for Ho-Chunk.
There'd be some kind of wager on this contest.
Right.
And would they be like physical contests or a whole variety of?
All a variety. You know, there's all types of different kind of games. Games played on blankets. I'm told that we wager on horse races, that we wager on lacrosse games. Yeah, so gambling's been, it's a part of what we do and what we have been doing. Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, there's a little bit of a misnomer out there. People think that it gave us gaming. The IGRA, Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, that Congress allowed us to gamble or to game as a way of economic development.
And about when would this have taken place?
IGRA took place in the 1980s. And so we started out with bingo halls, and to this day it's classified as a class two game. As opposed to class three games, which are what one traditionally thinks of as casinos, Las Vegas,
roulette, and
all the whole gamut.
Uh-huh.
Right. But the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, what it did is essentially it's legislation that regulates what we already are able to do because we're sovereign. Because each tribe, each federally recognized tribe is a sovereign. We're a nation within the United States. And so what the government did was sort of reach into our lands, into our nations, and said, well, we're going to protect you Indians, you Natives, against organized crime. We want to be sure this is regulated properly. And so that's essentially what gave rise to the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, regulated by the federal government. And we also self-regulate. We have our own gaming commission, and our gaming commission is responsible for assuring that there is integrity and that we're following minimum internal control standards. NIGC, which is National Indian Gaming Commission, establishes these policies, as it were. And so we do a tremendous amount of self-regulation. And in a Class 2 environment, like right here at Ho-Chunk Gaming Madison, we're exclusively self-regulated and regulated by the National Indian Gaming Commission. The state doesn't have anything to do with Class 2 gaming.
So this facility is in the Ho-Chunk Nation.
Yes.
But it still interacts with the federal government and the state government. Like, how do all those pieces, it's like you're working with three entities, three nations, and like, what authority does the Ho-Chunk Nation have over this space and this land?
Right. And it is. It's very complicated and certainly something I couldn't cover in any, you know, extensively or well. But it is, a lot of times, pretty complicated when you're dealing with the state, you're dealing with the federal government, local municipalities, counties. There's a lot of layers that the Ho-Chunk Nation and other tribes in the state and across the country have to negotiate and deal with. The casinos too, I mean, as a point of interest, I suppose people don't understand probably a lot of times, you know, how it is that the Ho-Chunk Nation or any other Indian maintains, or any Indian tribe maintains this quote unquote unfair or unlevel playing field, and by being able to operate casinos. And it's something I think that people need to understand is, again, this is sovereignty, it's an issue of sovereignty. We've always had this. We've always had this industry at our disposal. And it's a way for us, with so much has been taken away through a lot of methods, for us to try to recover. So it's not like some tribes that I understand are fairly wealthy, very few, precious few. Most of them just sort of squeak by. Ho-Chunk Nation, all we're trying to do is provide service, you know, funding for to provide services for our people, health care, education, elder housing, elder care, the whole gamut. And so that's what we try to do. And so when people sort of grouse about, you know, those Indians are getting rich, or they're, you know, it's unfair that they can operate and you know, a non-Indian entity cannot, that's up to the state. The state has a lottery. You know, there's other forms of you know, I guess, other ways for the state to engage in some gambling, but for us, it's that's all we got left. That's all we have. You know, we don't have from gaming, then we're trying to diversify, but that's even slow. You know, because if we try to diversify, the membership doesn't understand that the profit margins aren't going to be the same in any other business that we engage in. It's just not the same. You know, they're pretty substantial in the gaming industry. But it's our way of funding. We have a very limited land base, so our ability to tax is extremely limited, to tax our own members. And so really, our taxation are essentially for the taxes that we derive, if you will, are gaming revenues. And that's what we are able to provide our services for our people.
And what are some of those programs that are trying to empower the members of the Ho-Chunk Nation? What kinds of things would casinos be investing in terms of programs in Native communities?
I think one of the, well, for me personally, it's always been, when I got into office, education, you know, higher education was for me a priority. And it was always my dream to be able to fund our education department to a point where any child who graduates from high school would be able to attend any university in the world on the nation's dime. And the fact of the matter is that we do generate a finite sum of revenues, and we can't fund in that manner. A huge initiative that's been undergoing for quite some time is the preservation of the language. There's a good deal of funding that's allocated to preservation of the Ho-Chunk language. We have immersion programs. Our children right now, I'm told that the children who do participate in these programs are speaking fluently, because our fluent speakers are unfortunately they're passing away. You know, I would say an alarming rate, but anytime a Ho-Chunk elder passes away, a speaker passes away, with that goes not just the language, but stories and you know, things that we'll never be able to recapture. So there's a good deal of effort in preserving the language, the culture, for, you know, for our future.
In one of the times that Dan and I were hanging out earlier, he talked about the Ho-Chunk Church. A friend of mine was with me, asked, oh, where is the Native American Church in this area? He says, well, the Native American Church is wherever we gather. Often it's a living room. That becomes church. We don't have a building, the first Native Church of Madison, that sort of thing. It happens when we gather, which seemed to me to be incredibly biblical. But he talked about the gathering, the all-night gatherings that occur when the Native community, the Native church gets together. He says it's maybe what white people would call group therapy. And so I asked Dan to share a little bit about his own story, his own journey, as well as something about the Native American church and his experiences with racism as he moved from state to state and finally ended up here in Wisconsin, back to the roots of his Ho-Chunk tribe.
Well, I was actually born in Chicago. My mother and father met in Chicago. My mother's a full-blood Ho-Chunk. My father is he came from, he's first generation. His father was Scottish. And again, I was baptized as an Episcopalian, lived in Chicago. And we would, as a young guy, we would travel to Linden Station in Wisconsin here on I would say, my memory serves me correctly, almost every weekend. And we would go there to see my grandfather, my Choka. And so growing up, we would go to prayer meetings. And prayer meetings are our Native American church. It's an all-night event where we pray and provide an opportunity to talk about, you know, what's happening in your life at the time, what's, you know, what issues there might be, and it allows the rest of the group to pray for that person if they're having problems or having issues, and it's where we also consume the sacrament at that time, and then for us that's POD. And again, it's an all-night affair, and it's a very, very spiritual time, and it's very impressionable. It leaves a very profound impression on those who participate, you know, for a long time thereafter. Difficult times, as one might imagine, growing up from a split family, there's a lot of issues there. And it was interesting because in Indiana, I was probably the only Native, certainly the only Ho-Chunk, but the only Native student. And it was sort of celebrated. It was really kind of interesting in retrospect, because I never thought much about it, but people would ask, you know, are you Mexican, are you all different guesses, and it was always kind of fun. We share stories amongst the Ho-Chunk, you know, when people, the different guesses people have. And it was always nice, but because when you tell the folks there that, no, I'm Native, I'm Ho-Chunk, you're treated like a rock star. Wow, that's really cool. Oh, that's really neat. And, you know, then you get the you know, naive questions, you know, the riding horses and teepees and feathers and all that silliness. But that's just, you know, they people just don't know. And that's okay. So we fast forward to, I attended Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, graduated from there. I met my wife, and we moved to Wisconsin in 1993. It's the first time I experienced any kind of racist attitude. I'd never experienced that in my life. Again, it'd always been sort of a celebration and kind of a cool thing, kind of unique that there was an Indian amongst people. And when I got to Wisconsin, there was some very interesting occasions that a little shocking, quite frankly. And the attitude up here is a little bit different. You know, East Central Indiana is essentially Northern Kentucky. People from the South, generally, very nice. You know, the Southern charm, the yes sir, no sir, open the door, thank you, nice to see you, etc. Drive down the road, people wave at one another. And I move up here, and it's pretty cool. So I didn't attribute it all.
Cool as in cool attitudes,
yeah.
Not cool people.
Not cool people. Yeah. Just cool attitude. And just even driving down the road, if I were to wave at somebody, people would, like, just crane their necks as they went by, like, who is that? Who the heck was that? It's like, just do that. You just wave. You're just friendly. You go to a store and make small talk, and people just look at you like, what are you doing? Why are you talking to me? And I didn't attribute that completely to race. You know, I just thought this is just, you know, a general attitude up here. But there were other instances. If I walked by in a parking lot of a shopping mall or shopping, you know, store, people would lock their doors as I walked by. Or I've been stopped by law enforcement on a number of occasions for no particular reason other than I gotta assume just the way I look. And the attitudes in general about me, if I showed up to an event as the only Native there, you definitely sense something's awry. So quite a transition, the path, and it's not a woe is me, certainly, and nothing like that. It's just life up here because, you know, and I understand there's a history with Natives and non-Natives in this state and in this community. And you know, we all learn, we're looking past that, we want to just get along, we want to just, you know, but we still, a big part of what I'm trying to do too is in this community of Madison is to educate and assist people in getting to know who we are, because we're an enigma. a lot of ways, the Ho-Chunk are an enigma, you know, and we are, some of it is because of the way we've lived. What we do, our ways, are not for public consumption. You know, some of those traditional ways, I don't even know what that means, because I'm not a traditional Ho-Chunk. I'm a Native American church Ho-Chunk, and so it's a different, there's a difference there.
So some traditions are kept very close at hand to those who are Ho-Chunk but not part of the Native American church.
Right. And there's even division between the Ho-Chunk, or bigger part, between the traditional people and the Native American church members, because the Native American church has a lot of Christian elements to it. There's use of the Holy Bible, there's scriptures read, you know, in various ceremonies. The traditional, of course, predates Christianity, and so the traditional people have their way of looking at things, and they look down on Native American church because, well, you've adopted a European model. You're not practicing what we really are. And so there's that struggle too, I think, with a lot of, I'm guessing with some Ho-Chunk who are, you know, looking to be, to find themselves and to be spiritual. What does that mean? You know, is the Christian way to go, or the Native American church way to go? Is the traditional way, is that the way we're supposed to go? Am I supposed to go that way because I'm a Ho-Chunk? And so I think there's that struggle there. And quite frankly, some of our membership is, there's an Indian Baptist church. There's other, you know, other options, I guess, is a way to put it, for, you know, for Ho-Chunk people.
Dan then began to share freely about the forced migration that occurred with the Ho-Chunk people, or the Winnebago people, became known as Ho-Chunk. And I think we were both surprised at just how emotional that topic was for him. Though it happened many generations ago, there was a connection that he still felt very deeply.
Because I think about myself, I think about those removals, multiple removals from the state of Wisconsin to Minnesota to Iowa to Nebraska. And we kept coming back. You know, my relatives kept coming back, and what those journeys, what they meant in order to cross that Mississippi. How'd they get across the Mississippi? You know, there wasn't a bridge to just simply walk over. You know, I don't know. I don't know the history, and I don't know that it's taught somewhere. Surely there's some elders who know, but did it require making dugout canoes so we could get across? Did it require us waiting for it to freeze? In which case, that arduous journey was made that much more difficult by having to travel in freezing temperatures just to get back to the state of Wisconsin. What must that have been? And people don't think about that human element of that particular journey. How many Ho-Chunk did we lose coming back? How many people were buried along that trail? How many?
No.
Yeah. So, you know, there's that. There's just a very human element to that that people just can dismiss, and it's like, how do you not get that? And so we're so persistent. We come back again and again. The government finally throws their hands up and says, you know what? Let's just give these guys a homestead. Let's have them farm, and, you know, geez, we'll just let them stick around. But even before we get the homesteads, we're back in our own homeland living as fugitives. We're running away from soldiers. We're always in hiding. We rely on the kind settlers to help us just to survive, where beforehand we were helping them to survive before the removals transpired. And so those are the kind of things that need to be told. There has to be context to our relationship, I believe. And I think it's important for mainstream society to take a good hard look at that. And so when there's policy going forward, you know, people really understand that policy going forward that affects Ho-Chunk or Native communities. Let's not forget the history, and let's not forget what that meant. And I think for me, it's the most difficult part of of having a relationship is you got to have an understanding.
Yeah.
You know, from the beginning.
You say it'd be great to move on and just build a different future than we've had past.
Right.
What's that look like on the part of the official non-Native government or community toward Native communities?
I think a big step in the right direction is to remember what happened, to remember what was done, and to not ignore it. I think that's one of the biggest probably challenges, you know, to forming good relationships, and that needs to be taught on either side, the Ho-Chunk and then the non-Ho-Chunk. So we need to remember that, and we can't ignore what shapes history. We can't do that. We can't just move on and say, yeah, you guys were true. Yeah, your land was taken away. Yeah, whatever. Yeah, you were moved off your land. Whatever, get over it. That's no way to start a relationship. That's no way to move ahead. While we don't want to, you know, stay kind of mired in those tragedies of yesterday, we also don't want them forgotten. We want people to understand what we've overcome. It's not too much different than slavery in the United States. You know, that, you know, a lot of the community, the Black community, don't forget what you've done. You know, don't act like this didn't happen. Don't go to another country and impose whatever it is you're looking to do, whether it's colonialism, whatever you want to call it, but don't forget about yesterday. You're not, your hands aren't without blood. And so for us, our story, we're looking in this state or in this community to just tell the story, not with the idea of heaping guilt on anybody, but just remember, this is what we've overcome, and we're still here. And so when you're, you know, complaining about gaming, that's all you left us with. That's all we have in order to sustain ourselves, in order to remain, you know, economically viable, to provide services for our people, so that we're not relying on assistance, and that we're educating our tribal members, and that we're providing job opportunities for our tribal members. But we want to remember from whence we came. We'd never want to forget that. We want our children to forget that. It's what happened, you know, and it really sucks, you know, what happened in the past. It's really painful. You know, America should be ashamed. But again, not shamed. It's just the way it went down back then, and we're recovering now. We're proud as can be that we're survivors. I'm proud to be a survivor of that. You know, for my mother, who went through, you know, this whole assimilation effort with boarding schools, you know, and she suffered corporal punishment for speaking all language, and tell stories about how she ran away to hide, to talk to her friends so that she could speak Ho-Chunk with her friends, but you couldn't tell a teacher because you'd be whipped or you'd be otherwise, you know, punished. And, you know, surviving that, surviving an environment where you're taken away from your home. And so I've often said, I don't fault my parents for anything, because who they were, it's not, I mean, there's choices in life, but you're basically created by your parents. And so in an instance with my mom, my father went to English boarding school, and, you know, finally educated and so forth. Mom was forced into a Indian boarding school. And so I looked at both my parents and often thought, you know, again, I don't fault you. I don't think you're the best parents in the world, but I don't fault you. How can I? You know, if you're not parented, you can't parent. You know, and so there's a survival thing here for Ho-Chunk, you know, and that's what I'm proud of. And I think that's another part of a story that needs to be told, you know, in the community is, you know, we're tough, we're resilient, and we, as a people, as a Ho-Chunk people, we as best we can, we have to try to move ourselves away from the resent that's there for what happened to our, you know, our forefathers. It's tough. You know, it's real tough when you sit down and think about all the atrocities and all the things that were done to Ho-Chunk people. But we've got to come together and get, not recognize it, and together move past that so that we can have meaningful relationships.
You know, I'm aware that there could be a darker side to gambling. I've seen it firsthand. I've been in slum communities that are desperately, desperately poor, and people who are possessed of such an unreasonable hope that the little bit they have might be better spent on a gambling table than in feeding their family. They've so lost hope that earning any kind of income in any way through work is so outrageously out there that gambling becomes their only hope. So I've seen that. I've seen that desperation where despair turns into some unreasonable hope that throwing it into gambling is going to be a better way to generate income. But I'm believing that there is a place for this as income generating entertainment, particularly in its association with Native American community. Native American community managed to avoid mob influence or organized crime, and so the development of gaming in the Native community was separate from any kind of organized crime activity. The IGRA that Dan talks about, Indian Gaming Regulation Act, made sure that it wasn't connected to organized crime. The Ho-Chunk Casino in Madison is a Class 2 facility. That is, there's no roulette tables, card games, those sorts of things. And it has a 95% or better payout. That is, 95% of the money that goes into these machines comes out into somebody's lap. 5% is used to pay for the 200-plus employees that run the facility, as well as all of the other infrastructural pieces. And with those extra bits, they're able to fund so much in the nation, in the Ho-Chunk Nation. So there is something, I think, to be said for this as income generating, particularly when we've given so little to our native communities in terms of methods to generate income. They've been cut out of, excluded from the economy in the mainstream in many ways. So I'm beginning to see that there's a place for this, particularly in these Class 2 facilities that are on reservations that serve as income generators for those communities. I have a new respect for gaming facilities on Native reservations, and certainly an admiration for the survival spirit among the Ho-Chunk and others who've refused to allow physical or cultural genocide to swallow their people and their land and their languages and their ways. I set out to do a year's worth of podcasting, roughly one a month. This is number 12. So we're done with Voices from the Center. I appreciate you hanging in there, those of you who have listened to all 12 of them. I'll be returning now to a book project that I started and set aside to do this year of podcasting, which will be my first work of fiction. In fact, you may find some of the characters in these interviews in my book in some way, shape, or form, which will take place a few decades after an apocalyptic event in which the meek inherit the earth. So stay tuned. Thanks for listening. This has been Voices from the Center, and I hope you've enjoyed these podcasts.